President Donald Trump's appearance before a joint session of Congress got praise from pundits this week. But rather than being able to bask in the afterglow, the White House was then struck by a Russian election scandal. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. President Donald Trump stood at the podium on Tuesday night to survey congressional members who were waiting to see how he would do. While the Democrats said they saw nothing new, top GOP congressional leaders were almost giddy at his performance. But by the following night, a news story had taken center stage to report that during the presidential campaign, then-Senator Jeff Sessions, a Trump campaign supporter, met twice with a Russian ambassador. With rising discontent from Republicans and calls for his resignation from Democrats, Sessions, now Attorney General, announced that he was recusing himself from any investigation into last year's presidential campaign. Take a look at this latest turn of events. We have in our studio John Barkovich. He's the former chair of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee, and Mike Preddle with the Wicomico Democratic Club. Welcome to the program.
Morning.
Morning, Don.
So let's get to Jeff Sessions first. I got a series of statements that the Attorney General gave. During his confirmation hearing, he said, "I did not have communications with Russians, and I'm unable to comment." And then a statement after the revelation, he said, "I never met with any Russian official to discuss issues of the campaign. I have no idea what this allegation is about. It is false." And then in his announcement to recuse himself from any investigation, he said, "I should have slowed down and said, but I did meet one Russian official a couple of times." So, John, so what's going on here? There are obviously other contacts as well that have been revealed just this week. Well, what was your reaction to how this was handled by Sessions and the president?
Well, from my point of view, the whole Russian thing is just, it's a bunch of gobbledygook. There's never been any proof of any significant contact. So there is a lot of high volume, as my president called it, witch hunt, when it relates to Jeff Sessions. And I when I think of Jeff Sessions, when you see the question as it was asked live, the question goes on and on about CNN, blah, blah, blah. And so I think that Sessions didn't think of his meeting with the Russian ambassador in his office with his hat as being chairman or a member of the I think it's the Armed Services Committee.
Right, Armed Services Committee.
And he was meeting with him vis-a-vis issues relating to those that job. And I think that's why he wasn't thinking about that as a response to the question in terms of, "I met with Russians to deal with the election." So I think, I believe it was a legitimate, "I didn't remember," or "that didn't relate to the question that he was being asked." Having said that, I think what he did in terms of recusing himself from the investigation makes sense, because that will at least calm down some of the high-volume witch hunt stuff, because he said, "I'm going to recuse myself." He is not going to resign unless there's something much more significant that comes out than a meeting with the Russian ambassador at a social event and a meeting with the Russian ambassador in his office as a member of the Senate. Unless something else comes out, there's no way he is going to resign. And I don't think Trump will let him resign.
Hmm. What's your sense about it? How serious is this? And is this the end of it, or do you think that this is going to go on for Sessions?
Right. You won't be surprised to hear I disagree strenuously with my friend John.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think it's gobbledygook. And more importantly, 17 out of 17 agencies of the federal government that investigate these things did not think that the whole Russian thing was a bunch of gobbledygook. Unfortunately, most of the information that they've uncovered is classified, and therefore it hasn't been exposed to the public. So neither John nor I nor anyone else knows exactly what they have found. But certainly there is an issue there. I find that Senator Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, our comments are somewhat disingenuous. Everyone knows the timing of the meeting in the middle of December was right in the middle of the hubbub over
right,
the Russians
yeah.
hacking the communications from the both of the political committees. Everyone was talking about whether Russia's doing it. And lo and behold, he invites this gentleman to his office in the Senate to talk about something. Oh, he didn't even think about the fact that all this was going on at the same time. Also, we found out for the first time yesterday, that not only did he meet with this ambassador, who is described by some people, at least some former CIA people, as the spy master of the Russians in the United States, but that he also met through some sort of a backdoor entrance with the son-in-law, Jared, the son-in-law of the president, and with together with General Flynn at the same time. So, you know, certainly something was going on. We certainly don't know what it is yet. Hopefully the Senate committees will be given free rein to investigate. I will be surprised if, frankly, if the Attorney General is still the Attorney General a month from now. I think that probably he will be forced out, the way that General Flynn protested and everything was fine and nothing's going on. And the next thing you know, Flynn is forced out. He resigned. And I think that Sessions probably is doomed to the same fate.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Well,
and
it's
just
that, John.
And I don't understand why Democrats just can't admit that they had a terrible campaign and a terrible candidate. And somehow they lost the election, not because they had a terrible candidate and a terrible campaign. They lost the election because of some Russian influence on the campaign and the election.
But
and
John,
I just
John,
don't
John,
see
there,
that.
But, John, there are Republicans who have expressed concern. I mean, not beyond Lindsey Graham and so on. And not just about Sessions, but the whole Russian
John,
relationship.
Every Democrat I know
I
feels we had
that.
A bad campaign and that Mrs. Clinton didn't handle it very well.
Then why don't they just admit they lost because they had a bad campaign and a bad campaign?
We lost because the under the Constitution.
Oh, we lost because of the Russian.
No. Despite the fact that we did not run a very good campaign, we still got 3 million more votes than the Republicans did because of the way the Constitution set up that you know it wasn't an overwhelming.
So Trump played by the rules and won. Oh,
yes, he did. He played by the rules and he won. Okay.
Okay.
And there's no evidence at all that the Russians had any influence at all on the election.
Exactly. Your
president
said
question,
that.
But there's no question in the mind of these 17 intelligence agencies that they attempted to influence it, as today they're reportedly trying to influence three elections going on in Europe.
And they have in the past.
Okay, they have in the past.
This is not new.
So let me break in here for just a moment here, this moment of excitement.
Sure.
Well, so one of the things I'll address this to John is one of the things that really struck me is the Russians clearly had an interest in Donald Trump. That's clear,
and
particularly the ambassador, right? And so he's poking around, he's meeting with these people, he met with Sessions and so on. I would assume that the Russians did not have necessarily the best of motives, i.e., that they wanted to get in, they wanted to influence. And on the other hand, I'm wondering whether or not the people on the other side, this is the Trump people, whether or not they were just so inexperienced, they didn't realize, you know, this isn't a good idea. And their experience in government, with maybe the exception of Sessions, was such that they didn't realize that this may not be a proper thing to do.
Well,
right? I mean, you see, in others, there are these two sides that kind of come together, you know?
I want to answer that just in this way, that if I'm in Russia and I'm a world power, there's no question they are. And I have experience dealing with Hillary as Secretary of State and Obama for the last 8 years as president. It would seem to me that I would be very anxious to get an inside picture of what this guy Trump might be. And so that the concept of let's get our ambassador to meet these guys and get some sense of where this guy might go if, in fact, he's elected president. Because I don't think they necessarily – there's no one has ever shown that they necessarily wanted Trump to be president. On the other hand, they might have been better off with Hillary as president because they knew exactly what her program was going to be, because it would be the same as Obama's for the last year. And they've been whitewashing Obama for the last 8 years. Why wouldn't they want a continuation of that? So I think if Russia wanting to know about Trump and his people makes sense to me. And the ambassador, who has been proven to be a gregarious, social kind of guy, would be the excellent person to go and find out what these people
think. Did Trump people then get manipulated by the Russians?
No, I don't think they did.
In the sense that they had these encounters which now have come back to haunt them?
That would only be if they changed the way they ran the campaign because of some input from Russia. And Trump's campaign started a year and a half ago, long before this Russian issue ever came up. And his campaign never really changed from day one when he came down that escalator to the day he was inaugurated. He said the same thing day in and day out.
Let me respond to that very there is a very long story in the New Yorker, which came out yesterday, actually, talking about how beginning in 1982, the Russians tried to win over Ronald Reagan. And he saw through it, and he stood up to them, and they hated him for it, okay? And for every president since then, the Russians have made these approaches and have been rebuffed. And they hated Obama and Hillary Clinton because they refused to be seduced by the Russians' attempts to win them over. But They found out that Donald Trump was a different kind of man. Beginning about 5 years ago, they found that he was such a narcissist that they could ply him with all sorts of compliments. They invited him to have the Miss Universe contest in Moscow, and they wined and dined him and fixed him up, with, depending on who you believe. They fixed him up with some lady friends over there, according to some of the reports.
We don't know, but some
reports, and it may be scurrilous. I don't know. But certainly it's clear that they did, in fact, succeed in winning him over. And he became a good friend of the Russians. And for the last 5 years or so, he has maintained a good relationship with them. Some of it's business, and he did a lot of business over there. He refuses to give us his tax returns, so we can't see how much business or what business he did over there. But I say, again, I don't mean to be dumping it off on a story, but there is a very good article which goes through in great detail all of the efforts that have been made by the Russians over the years to win over not only this president but future presidents, and they succeeded with this president.
I'm sure the New Yorker is fair and balanced.
Read the article, John.
Okay, well, I want to turn to the main subject at hand, which, of course, is the president's appearance before a joint session of Congress. As I mentioned in the opening, he did get compliments from pundits. We saw some public opinion polls, which indeed said that there was approval. I think CBS said something about 76% approval of the speech. CNN, I think, was 70%. But Mike, by the way, just note that Obama in his first one got 90%, but okay. John, what did you make of the speech? Is this a difference now in tone? Is something being turned in terms of a corner? Or are we going to see this and then we're going to be back to the old Trump with maybe a tweet?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that. Because I personally interpreted everything he said as really nothing had much changed in terms of his policy, okay? There was really no change in his policy. What there was a difference in his approach. Tone is a word that's used. But I think he's sort of getting into the presidential aspect of this. Up until now, he's been a CEO of a company with worldwide contacts. And I think he's starting to realize that the presidency is an entirely different situation. And there are issues that he has to address in a more thoughtful, okay, approach. But I don't think he said anything different, so that the people that were reacting to it were reacting to the presence and the tone. The term presidential came up. And so that's the first time it's been used with Donald Trump. And there have been times when he gets off the teleprompter and has acted in the CEO fashion as opposed to the presidential fashion. So I think for him it was a home run, as described by Ryan. And I think it was a chance for the people to see that this man does have presidential potential.
Mike, what was your assessment? And one of the interesting things, there was someone on, I think Van Jones, was on CNN, who suggested that if Trump continues the kind of tone that we saw, obviously with still the same policies, that it could be dangerous for Democrats and for whatever Democratic agenda there is over the next 4 years.
Well, I agree with just about everything John said, and I agree with what Van Jones says. The president was actually accused of being presidential, which seemed to shock a lot of people, you know, and I think he was relatively presidential. I don't think it was a very consequential speech because he did basically repeat what
nothing's
he
changed.
Had been saying in
yes.
the past. Yeah. You know, as some wag put it, you know, it was basically Reince Priebus putting a power over the Bannon ideas, you know, which I guess is one way of explaining it. But I think it was a good statement. He did back off from a few things. I thought it was funny because during the last week he has been vituperative in his attacks on the press. And, of course, that wasn't mentioned at all. And also the whole Russian incident was, you know, blown up to some extent both before and after. And I don't think he mentioned Russia
well,
at all.
I don't think that
speech.
Was part of what he wanted to do.
No, we
have to remember the venue.
Yeah, I mean,
when he's in front of a crowd of his supporters, that's one Donald Trump.
I agree, Don.
But when he's
agree,
in
John.
Congress
yes.
talking to Republicans and Democrats and trying to
right.
explain
right.
what he wants to get done and the fact that he needs the help of all the people in that I think that's what brings on that different tone.
Well, I thought it was interesting, too, that, you know, he did indicate about a half dozen things that have been anathema to the Republicans and especially to the conservative Republicans for years. And, of course, they got all the applause. And, you know, and the Democrats applauded also. He talked about $1 trillion for infrastructure, which Obama has been trying to get money for 4 or 5 years with no cooperation at all from the Republicans. He talked about a jobs plan, which has been rejected out of hand by the Republicans in the past. He talked about negotiating drug prices, and that's something that Obama tried to get and couldn't get the Republicans to move on. He talked about the TPP, which has been basically supported by the Republicans and criticized by the Democrats. And, you know, now they've seemed to have flocked to his position on that. So it was interesting, too, that apparently on the same day he had met with some news people, and he talked about a compromise plan on immigration. And the more he talked about it, the more it sounded exactly like the plan that had been approved by the Senate in the past, the so-called Gang of Eight plan. And, of course, he then retreated in this speech back to the Bannon. You know, if he did anything that was, in my judgment, insensitive, he did repeat his attack on immigration in general. And I think that
But having just said that, all those things that you just said, and I'm not disagreeing with any of those, how come none of the Democrats would stand up and clap?
They did clap for all of those things, John. They did.
They never ever suggested that they were going to support Donald Trump by their actions and their appearance.
Because he gave them no reason to, because he, you know.
If he's coming up and saying, I want to build our infrastructure, I want to find more jobs, I want to change our tax code. If he's saying these things, how can Democrats say, we don't want to help or we don't want to be involved?
They haven't said
that.
They didn't pull Mitch McConnell. He's been approached by the Dems have said, let's sit down and talk about infrastructure tomorrow. And, you know, we're waiting for him to do that.
I would suggest, by the way, that he may have more problems with the Republicans when it comes to things
like infrastructure. There's no question about it. I'm not denying that.
But I have not heard anyone.
But that's why he's going to need Democrats. He's going to need some Democrats.
Okay. I have not seen anyone on the Democratic side say we don't want to talk to the president about infrastructure or about drug prices or about jobs plan. We've invited a paid family leave, which apparently is Ivanka's thing, which the Dems have been asking for years, and he's apparently adopted that as a sop to his daughter. The Democrats have indicated overwhelmingly that they're willing to talk about these things. They can't wait to get those talks started.
They're too busy talking about Russians.
No, they're talking about Russia, too. The Republicans are talking about Russia also.
Right. It was a good speech. It was well-received by the nation, even if it wasn't by the Democrats who were in attendance. And I still think it was a giant positive. And I think as he goes forward, he will learn that kind of approach, the presidential quote-unquote approach, will be beneficial to him and his program.
Let me ask you a turn to probably the most emotional moment, which was Karen Owens, the widow of the senior chief, William Ryan Owens. He's a Navy SEAL who was killed in the Yemen operation. The president called it a success. I guess there's some discourse about whether or not it was or not, but putting that aside, what did both of you make of that? I'll start with you, Mike, because we saw these images of her. It was a very long applause, of course, for her. She was crying. She certainly looked up. I think at one point the president said something about winning something or the longest applause in the history of the of an address to a congressional session like that. What, Mike? I'll start with you. What was your emotional response, and what was your analytic response?
It may be personal to me, but I hate it when Democrats do that, and I hate it when Republicans do that, to put somebody up there and, I mean, pull out a story and then, you know, pull everybody's heartstrings. I think that is it's manipulative, and I think that it's demeaning to do that. And I, frankly, was embarrassed for the woman who was standing there crying with the eyes of the world focused on her, you know. And some people may eat that up, but I inclined to think that it's manipulative and I hardly dislike
it. And John, what was your own reaction and the fact that while this was going on, we had his father saying that he did not want to meet with Donald Trump when the body came back.
Yeah.
So there was sort of this disconnect. On the one hand, we saw these great, you know, these visuals of this very emotional moment. And on the other hand, in the background, we get this sort of discord about how successful it was, but also the father having weighed in before that.
Remember, he went to Dover when that body came back. So he had interest in this seal long before the presidential address. He went there to receive the body in Dover. And yes, the father, I'm sure, had issues. I don't know what his politics were, but he couldn't deal with it. But obviously the widow was not opposed to having her husband's bravery and his sacrifice recognized at a congressional level.
You don't know that, John. You don't know that.
And so when I saw that, it brought tears to my eyes to see her. And I think the outpouring that you saw was legitimate for a widow who lost her husband in the defense of our country. And I think that's real. And I think, yes, Donald has that feeling as well. Donald Trump had that feeling as well, that this was the first soldier killed under his administration, and he felt it appropriate to recognize the sacrifice that the widow had made for the country.
By the way, John, just quickly, what did you make of the fact that prior to this, when he was asked about the death, he seemed to be saying, well, this operation began before my watch. The generals wanted to do it. They lost him. Sounded to a lot of people that he wasn't taking responsibility. I know there's been some interpretive issues there. But
if he wasn't taking responsibility, he wouldn't have been in Dover to receive the body.
Okay.
If he wasn't taking responsibility, he wouldn't have had the widow there. Yes, this was a decision made prior to his arriving as president, but it was committed under his administration. He knows it's still his responsibility as commander-in-chief.
John, you're not that naive. You're not that naive to know that these aren't politically staged events. And when I say,
when Democrats are politically staged events, but is there legitimacy to it? That's the question I'm
addressing. Donald Trump is such a warm-hearted individual, right?
I believe that.
I don't think you're more naive
than I believe that to be the case.
You're more naive than I think.
He wouldn't have gone to Dover with his daughter to receive the body if he didn't feel strongly
about it. He was told by the politicians that was a great photo op.
Okay.
Look, I mean, when reporters take the face, how do you feel about your husband being killed in action? You know, what do you say? I mean, I think that's demeaning, and
I think it
was revolting.
And
I find
it revolting. And nobody denies it, except me.
Okay, I'm alone on that.
Okay, so let me turn to the Affordable Care Act. The president mentioned repeal, then laid out some things like tax credits and so on, seeming to embrace sort of a broadly anyway House Speaker Paul Ryan's ideas about how to reform it. John, I'll start with you. Where do you think the Republicans are on Capitol Hill on this? This word that they have some kind of plan that maybe is now almost put together, although apparently Senator Rand Paul had a hard time finding it on the Capitol Hill in this some secret room or whatever. Where are we? How close is this? You indicated before we went on the air that that they had to do this first.
Right.
Where are they on this? And
well, I think President Trump has a plan, and I think Price has a plan. And he's talked about it, and I think there probably is something put down on paper someplace through Paul Ryan. There's no question about that. Now, will they be able to get every Republican? No, because Rand Paul, there are a couple of other conservatives who have raised issues about the money involved and et cetera, et cetera. And this will be the first example, I think, where it will be Trump's leadership that gets something done. Because he is committed to getting rid of Obamacare. He's not talking about tinkering with it. He's not talking about making small changes. He's talking about getting rid of Obamacare and replacing it with a plan. And so I think that's a strong enough. He's made that such an important part of his campaign that I don't see how he's going to let Congress get away with not doing it.
Mike?
I think the quote of the month is the president saying, nobody knew health care could be so complicated. Gee, I knew it, and John knew it, and Nancy Pelosi knew it, and Barack Obama knew it, and Hillary Clinton certainly knew it. But Donald Trump just found out this week that it's a complicated job. And, I think the thing is a farce. Here we have the Republicans who have complained bitterly for 8 years that the ACA, the so-called Obamacare, was put together in secret by people who, you know, didn't want to work with us and that sort of thing. And now Rand Paul, the only doctor in the U.S. Senate, can't get a copy of it because it's so secret now that even the half of the Republican Party are not permitted access to it. Rand Paul actually went out yesterday and bought a copying machine and took it down to the locked room where they were keeping the only copy of the plan, and so he could make a copy of it.
I don't think they want the plan out. I don't think they want the plan out until they've had a chance.
Why don't you let me talk? I know you know more than I do about all these things, but I am of the view that...
Somebody start the stopwatch, okay?
I am of the view that we're not going to have a replacement for Obamacare unless it looks very, very much like Obamacare. As was reported, the president met earlier in the week, I think, before the speech, with a bunch of Republican governors who were up in arms because every version of the plan that they had heard about was going to cause severe damage to that, both of their reelection chances and to their state budgets. And therefore, you're not going to touch the 500,000 people in Kentucky, even though I say it's a disaster in Kentucky, but you're not going to take health care away from my constituents. So I really don't think, after 8 years of telling us how they were going to do it, and Mr. Obama saying it's going to happen on the first day of his administration, I think they're still as confused and as learning about how complicated it could be.
There's a big difference between Republicans generating bills that they know are not going to be signed and Republicans generating a bill that they know the president will sign. And so I think they want to make sure they get it right. And that's why I think they're trying to do this in sort of the sub rosa. Let's get together. Let's get our leaders together. Let's look at this plan and work it through, and then we'll present it to the body as a whole. And so I think that makes sense, because they know Trump will sign it. When the repeal bill hits, Trump will sign it. When the replace bill hits, Trump will sign it, as long as it meets his demand.
We need to get the Democratic response, okay?
Yeah.
Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear, he's, matter of fact, instituted the Affordable Care Act. He did a state exchange, was said to be highly successful. There do seem to be some issues in terms of the number of providers per county, I guess.
There's always issues.
That has come out. So I'm going to you, Mike. My own personal feeling about the speech was on substance, it was probably the most direct attack I think I've ever seen in terms of a response to an address to Congress. I mean, I think that is true. On the other hand, the guy is 72 years old, fairly old, and as somebody pointed out, what kind of image does this project in terms of trying to get voters to support the Democratic Party, and especially new voters? I mean, what both substance but also impressionistically.
I thought he was rather effective, frankly. I mean, being from a state, you know, we hear all about the coal miners in Kentucky, you know, but he was a very popular governor, and apparently Kentucky had one of the most successful rollouts in the nation in their health plan. You know, so, you know, it apparently was very well received and still is relatively well received, despite the reaction of the present governor, the present Republican governor of Kentucky. You know, I mean, I think there is so much fog being thrown up. I just saw this morning that Price, the new Human Services, says the health insurance premiums went up by an average of 25%. The Kaiser Family Foundation said, well, it's actually closer to 3%, which is a significant slowdown over the past 15 years. So, you know, who's to be believed? We'll see down the road.
I believe Arizona went up 110%. So there you go. There's Obamacare at work.
Oh, well, as a matter of fact, and the next time we meet together, we will check that number out.
All right. By that time, we will have this new plan in effect. And
right.
Boy, the world
and everything will be good.
Everybody will be smiling.
Everybody will be smiling.
We've been talking with John Barkovich. He's the former chair of the Wicomico Republican Central Committee, also Mike Prettle with the Wicomico Democratic Club. Appreciate you guys stopping by and chatting with us. We'll certainly do this again.
It was fun. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
I hope you can join us this Friday at 8 for Vintage Country with me, Tom Pittman. We're going to have you some great country music from the time between World War II and Watergate. Top of the second hour, we're going to be bringing you the top 10 for the year 1963. That's here on WSDL.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And is this news?
I didn't always want to go to the senior center because I have arthritis, and my arthritis began to hurt. And I didn't want to go there and play bridge was much more fun to go shoplifting.
Bringing you all the parts of the world that don't fit into the daily news programs. Go out of your way for it. This American Life from Public Radio International.
Saturdays at noon on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Maryland's state budget is already under a strain with a major revenue shortfall. But Annapolis is bracing for more bad news from Washington. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Governor Larry Hogan presented a slimmed-down $43.5 billion budget as the Maryland Republican faced a $544 million deficit. But Republicans in Washington are vowing to repeal the Affordable Care Act, so the pain could get much worse. In our studio this morning to take a look at these and other issues is State Senator Jim Mathias, one of the few remaining Democrats on the Eastern Shore. Welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Well, it's a beautiful morning.
That's right. So let's turn, first of all, to the budget. The governor has proposed what's been described as sort of a slimmed down budget of some $43.5 billion. Obviously, he was facing a $544 million shortfall. How do you assess where we are in terms of the budget and tackling the kind of shortfalls that we're seeing?
Well, we're working for compromise. We're working together to go forward. That's been the good relationship I've had with Governor Hogan. And let's look at what happened. This hasn't been a spending problem. It was a forecasting problem. You know, we have to remember that we were in the greatest recession, the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression. So I think we've all done exceedingly well and been able to continue to provide the services that Marylanders want. Education, we've continued to make record appropriations. And the governor did something this year that hasn't been done for some time. He took some money from the rainy day fund, did it over 2 years, made sure that it was in accord with our bond rating companies and the like. So I think we're doing well. And we're looking not only to stay within the parameters of the budget, relieve that pressure from our Maryland taxpayers, but try to start to put some money back, let's say, for the Highway User Fund. That's something that we were able to do for municipalities over the last couple of years, and we're looking to do it in the counties because it's sorely needed.
Do you see this as a phase, that is, that shortfall will eventually disappear as we move into better economic times? I know when I talked to Comptroller Peter Franchot, he suspected that better economic times were ahead, and we had to sort of steady the course until we get to that other end.
Well, certainly, but we have to make sure that we're fiscally responsible the entire time that we're there. We can't be budgeting for booms and busts. We have to make sure that we have a level. You know, they call, you know, the actuarial people, when I was the mayor of Ocean City, and when we were doing our pensions, sometimes they wanted to do smoothing over a long time. But we have to make sure that we're fiscally responsible over the long haul, that we're providing the services, and we're doing within the parameters, the taxing parameters. I haven't voted for any new taxes, and I don't intend to. But the fact of the matter is we have to make sure that we provide the services for a better Maryland, a better, stronger Eastern Shore, and working together with our governor, with Governor Hogan. And he is our governor. I've worked very well with him from day one with the PMT, and I can talk about some other things here on the program we've been able to do together.
So one of the things that struck me, I saw the other day, that the governor said he would like to see some tax cuts. The comptroller said he doesn't want to see any tax cuts. He wants everything to stay the same until we see what the future holds. Neither one of them, of course, said they won't favor any kind of tax increase. Do you think this is a time for tax cuts, or do you think we should, as Franchot says, put that off until we see better numbers?
Well, the first thing we need to do is get the forecasting correct. And, you know, that has been the variable that's really been problematic. We've come through now where we've hit a stability in recovery. Still here on the Eastern Shore, we're still one of the slowest areas to recover. We'll talk about that, too. There was a bill the governor's put in trying to encourage manufacturing. Somerset County's in the bill. Worcester County's in the bill, but Wicomico County wasn't in the bill, and I went and asked to have that amended this week because, you know, one false move like Saffron, when Saffron left here, 600 jobs, can completely invert our economic conditions here. So we have to make sure that we hit that stability before we start talking about going forward. I think, you know, the governor's done some good things. He reduced the tolls on the Bay Bridge. There was some concern that was echoed by some of the bond rating agencies there with their transportation bonds. So you take it where you can get it. I know that the good news is both the leadership in the legislature, as you well know, it's a Democratic majority legislature, and the executive branch are talking to find common ground. So I think that if we stay the course, if we keep doing what makes Maryland strong, if we take these incentives for manufacturing but still protect, like my mother always said, God bless her soul, Jimmy, take care of what you have first. What do we have here on the Eastern Shore? Agriculture, poultry, tourism, small business, our universities, our community colleges. Not only are these centers for learning, but they're centers for employment here. So we have to protect and preserve them, do our appropriations. And if, in fact, and I already talked about the highway user money here, give some of those dollars, bring some of those dollars back here for our counties and continued for our municipalities. When we do that, and if we can see that cushion, restore those monies that the governor, I believe, smartly, responsibly, was able to borrow, let's say, from the rainy day fund, be able to put those dollars back, then I think it's time to talk about cuts, yes.
By the way, one of the things that's been hanging, that sort of hangs over all of the states, and I've asked a number of representatives from the Eastern Shore, that is the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely.
The potential that it'll either be repealed or that it might be block granted. I saw a set of figures that if, for instance, the Affordable Care Act were repealed, you could be adding as much as $7.7 billion loss over the next 5 years in funds for the state. Do you have any sense about, A, what impact that would have, and B, whether or not the state could deal with such an effect? And C, have you talked to the governor about what might be the possible ramifications of this? Have we talked, for instance, to our local congressman, Andy Harris, who clearly has favored repeal of the Affordable Care Act? How does that fit together for you?
Well, first of all, realize here on the Eastern Shore, we have some of the most impoverished folks here. And let's take a look at Somerset County and look at the amount of a Medicaid subsidy there is here. Folks that we have been able to bring health care to. It's critically, critically important. You know, before we had the Affordable Care Act, we had MHIP here in Maryland. We did have a subsidy program, MCHIP. So I know that Maryland is going to do its part to be a leader. I worked very closely with the healthcare exchange, bringing it here. I have been fortunate since I've been in the Senate to be on the Senate Finance Committee. The jurisdiction is healthcare and healthcare insurance. You asked me if I've spoken with the governor. I've spoken with some of his legislative folks about this. I think that they share that concern, trying to find it in a practical way. I have talked with Senator now Chris Van Hollen, talked with Senator Cardin about this. And they truly are poised to make sure that we have that those portions of the Affordable Care Act that make good sense here. Look, any law that when you bring it forward is not a perfect law. There's time when time goes forward that you find better ways to improve it. And I think that all of us, whether we're Democrats or Republicans, would look to, if there are improvements out there, to bring those improvements forward. But how about the parents that were able to keep their children until they're 26 to be able to continue to keep them insured? How about pre-existing conditions that were there? My God, look at my own family with my late wife with a catastrophic illness like cancer. You turn around, you never know. You're healthy, you leave the house, and the next thing you know, anything could happen. So we want to make sure, and in Maryland, there's a lot of uniqueness here about our health care program and policies in Maryland. We are a all-payer state, where even if you do not have health insurance and you're ill and you walk into a hospital, they are required here in Maryland to treat you. So if whether that becomes a debt that the hospital, some people say write it off, but they have to absorb, their hospital costs go up. What we've been able to do here in Maryland by insuring more people actually is push insurance rates down, insure more people, early detection, preventive health policies that are allowed when people are afforded when people have health insurance. So I support it. I believe in it. As I got older, I can reach in my wallet right now, I will tell you, and I got a few valuables in there. But the most valuable card I have in my wallet is my health insurance card. I turned 65 this year, and I want to make sure. I just had a new my first grandson was born. Christian Alexander, and I want to be here and be healthy for him and for my family. And I know our listeners share that same feeling. So we're going to work together to do our very best. And if, in fact, we have to keep a very, very watchful eye on Washington, some of the policies that are coming from Washington, but if they become adverse to Marylanders, I'm confident in the leadership in Maryland. both our Democrats and finding compromise with our governor, we're going to be able to make certain we'll manage those costs, but bring that access to health care.
By the way, have you talked to Congressman Andy Harris's people at all? He's been a strong opponent of the Affordable Care Act. Last time I talked to him, he talked about it needed to be repealed. He obviously did not have a very high opinion of it. And I guess one of the questions is, particularly on the Eastern Shore, this was Trump country. This is a country that Andy Harris certainly has a lot of support. And you can hear a lot of people express skepticism about the Affordable Care Act on the shore itself. Have you talked to him at all? What sense do you get about the feeling on the shore?
Well, the short answer is no, I haven't spoken with the congressman of the first district.
Right.
I have not. And over the time that he's been there, I expressed to him my condolences when he lost his wife. But beyond that, respectfully, we really don't have a lot of conversation. Can't tell you why, but we don't. What I can tell you is, yes, as a matter of fact, look, our electorate spoke in this election, and they spoke resoundingly, particularly here. It's my job to make this work. I can't go back as to what the outcomes were. The process provided a president. The process provided a congressman from the first district. It's my job to work with the system to make this work. So I'm on the Committee of Jurisdiction, as I've already said, on Senate Finance. Before the Affordable Care Act, we had public access to health care insurance for both adults and children. I'm hoping that this will be a process that evolves, that is not repealed. And if, in fact, that becomes a political mindset of Washington is to repeal, I'm certainly hoping that it's repeal and replace so that we don't put great anxiety in people worrying about their children, their health care, their quality of life as they move forward.
I want to turn to what the governor called the roadkill bill. This is a bill that requires scoring of transportation projects. There's a lot of pushback, particularly from Democrats who represent, for instance, the urban areas, who say this is a good measure. The governor says, no, it's not. Where are you on that?
Well, clearly, as I said, I've had a very good working relationship with Governor Hogan. And as that bill moved out originally, it was a ratings bill to rate projects. And there were different categories that had to be rated. There was not a binding bill. Okay. But I voted against the bill. Hmm. I voted against the bill. And when Governor Hogan vetoed the bill, I voted to support his veto. I believed that we could find compromise. Now, I've been quoted in the Ocean City Today early on before we went back that if a bill comes to the floor to repeal, I'll vote for the bill, but that it has to endure tremendous committee hearings. Now, President Miller, he has stood on the podium numerous times and said to the governor, you know, the governor's folks and the lobbying folks and all, we're online. Our hearings are online. You can listen to the hearings. And the governor's legislative folks sit in their offices. They listen. They may not necessarily attend in the gallery, but they listen. President Miller said numerous times, both publicly and privately, to the governor, give us something to work with. Give us your compromise. We're willing to work this bill to your, let's say, satisfaction, where this will work for you. As of today, I was talking on my ride over. We haven't heard or seen those compromises, but I voted against the bill. I voted to support the governor's veto. I've been quoted as saying, if the bill comes to the floor, I'll vote for it. So that's the spirit of working together, and I do work with my colleagues in the Senate towards that end. And when the president of the Senate speaks, now he's known Governor Hogan for a very long time, since Governor Hogan was a child, and President Miller drove. He was a driver for Governor Hogan's dad when Governor Hogan's dad was in Congress. They have a great working relationship. They may not agree on everything at times, but they certainly know how to work together. So I know that offering has been made, and I'll be part of it if and when the time comes.
Why do you believe the governor's claim that, as it stands now, 66 to 73 transportation projects would be canceled?
From his perspective, that's his claim. Folks that I talk to say, look, this is not a binding bill. If, in fact, he would select a road that had lower point scores, merely what he has to do is write a letter and explain why that roadway was picked. Now, look, I represent rural Maryland. I represent the Eastern Shore, the Lower Eastern Shore. When you look at the deadly roadways that we had on Route 113, my former partner here, former chair Norm Conway, he and I worked together during the worst economic time to bring appropriations for two of the last three parts of that roadway down there to get dualized. So we know that that was a dangerous road, and certainly I wouldn't want anything to impede that. And then when Governor Hogan made some of the decisions he made with regards to the red line in Baltimore and the purple line, some of those dollars that freed up, he reappropriated across the state. I want to thank him for that reappropriation for that last phase on 113. So whether it was a Democratic governor with Democratic leadership, times were tough. We had to figure out how to get those monies. Or a Republican governor that faced some, policy changes. He'll figure it out. Again, I want to say, and our Senate president has extended his arms to say, let's work this out. Give me some compromise so that I can work with our Senate body. I'm there to work. I'm there to make it happen.
By the way, how much of this do you think is a matter of rural areas versus urban areas, that there's this difference? And, you know, since the Republican governor has come online, at least from a visual sense, impressionistically, a lot more road work certainly seems to be going on the Eastern Shore. I see the governor a lot more, for instance, than I did, say, for instance, his predecessor on the shore. Is there a tension there, do you think?
Well, let's answer a couple parts of that question first. Look, the governor has been here on the Eastern Shore. His predecessor was here at times, too. But look, let's remember, I just mentioned before, not to take anything away from anybody, we were saddled with a great economic downturn. So it was a different time. I did not vote for the gas tax. I want to make sure that's clear. But a gas tax with additional revenues were passed during our previous governor, and it gives this governor revenue opportunity. So the improved economy, additional revenue opportunity has given this governor some different funds or a stronger budget perhaps to work with. So, look, to his credit, you look at this is a bit off the mark in a way, not the mark but the topic, when you look at how our casinos have matured and that we have revenue today. We have revenue today in this budget scheme that we did not have under the previous governor, or haven't matured to that. So, look, if you want to be fair and you want to be honest, the economy has improved. There's different revenue streams that are there. Now, I think that needs to be taken into consideration. But people have still been slow to recover, particularly here on the shore. So when the governor comes in like he did and met with County Executive Bob Culver and Mayor Jake Day and announces the continuation of policies like the monies we need to continue the renovation of the Purdue Stadium. That's a tremendous economic engine for us here. When he comes in and talks about monies necessary for water and wastewater treatment plants, when he talks about sustained appropriations of in Worcester County and Somerset County, that's important. I'm thankful that the economy has that strength. And I'm thankful that it has those revenue line items that we didn't have before. Some I voted for, some I didn't, like tax increases. But I look at any governor, particularly Governor Hogan, in their context. I think he's doing a good job with the rural areas. I think I try to stay above the fray when they have the back and forth. I need my friends from both rural Maryland and I need my friends from urban and suburban Maryland. I just want to say there's 47 senators. I need 24 of them at least to get a bill passed. And there's 141 delegates, and I need 71. When that same bill leaves the Senate and goes over to the House, I need 71 of them in the House to pass my bill. We don't have 24 Eastern Shore senators, and we don't have 71 Eastern Shore delegates. So I have to have a solid working relationship of respect and be there for them as well as I ask them to be there for me.
By the way, where are you on the, I guess they're called the contained animal feeding operations called CAFOs. These are the large poultry operations that have sprung up on the Eastern Shore and on Delmarva. And the biggest complaint that I have heard is not so much that they exist, but that they pop up near areas where there are homes. We saw that, for instance, in Somerset County not too long ago. We end up, there's a proposal, I guess, that's right near Salisbury now, just in Wicomico County, where I talked to residents. They were really concerned about that. I know there's a bill in the legislature now to have the Maryland Department of the Environment take a look at air emissions and air pollution. Where are you on that? Because the opposition or the criticism of these operations aren't coming from environmentalists. They aren't coming from the Western Shore. These are longtime residents, some of whom actually voted for Donald Trump, who's conservative. They're not liberals, but they say, I don't like this.
I understand. They're concerned about their quality of life, as they should be, as they should be. And first of all, I believe that those issues are zoning issues. They're local issues. And when those folks have that concern, when they go to their local counties, whether they be Wicomico or Somerset or Worcester County, and go to their county commissioners, I think really that's where the action should take place. Now, when you look at who funds our health departments and you look at our water quality and air quality, the state has a role. So I believe that there's a shared role with the county, a shared role with the state. But I think the most important thing, when you look back at the Maryland Coastal Bays and you look at the role that they play, is to have a functional round table where there's not – where there just doesn't come down to winners and losers, where we have our poultry industry, our agriculture industry, our residential folks are there, our environmental community. We're at the round table, and we can seek and find compromise. We've been able to do that, Don, and that's what government's all about.
Well, let me break in there and ask you, because I've talked to a number of the residential folks who have concerns about this, and some of them are saying the local government officials aren't listening, as far as they're concerned, that the limits on these poultry operations are not good enough. And some have said that, gee, people in Annapolis, at least from the Eastern Shore, they don't seem to be listening to us. What do you say to those people who have that concern, that locals aren't doing enough and they feel the representatives from the Eastern Shore are not listening? Do you say to them?
Well, clearly, I say to them, I'm listening. I understand. I'm talking with the folks in the state health department and MDE. I get along very well with Secretary Grumbles. He understands what's going on. But you know what happens when people don't listen? As my mom, I know this is the second time I've quoted my mother. She says, Jimmy, if you don't listen, you're going to have to feel. It's 2017, and we're starting to trend towards an election in 2018. That's the best amplifier I know is the ballot box. So I understand it, but also I want to make sure that the practicality of this industry, the agriculture industry, grain and poultry, is critically important here. I don't know of a farmer that would want to exclude a quality of life for anyone. And certainly to say, well, who was here first, that becomes an emotional argument. How can we say who can stay here with a quality of life best? So when the air quality is an issue, they talk about how much larger the poultry houses are today. That's not necessarily at all for more chickens. That is for some of the houses that have gone away, that have become obsolete, right. Living qualities and the like.
It just seems that it's a location issue.
Yes.
As opposed to, you know, if you build one of these things out in the hinterland, nobody has a problem, right?
Right. Well, and again, not in my backyard.
Right.
You know, who wants a prison in their backyard? Who wants a poultry farm? Who wants a manufacturing plant? But regardless, that's what zoning is about. Residential areas are for residential. Commercial areas are for commercial. But here we have a blended use here. We have areas where we've had farms, and farms which included poultry houses also have included subdivisions over the years, where those homes have kind of bumped up closer, let's say, to the development of those poultry houses that some people would like. I still think the remedy can be found in local government. That's where I truly believe that it is, and we will be there. I know that, again, I'll talk about Wicomico County Executive Bob Culber. He's talked to me about working with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, looking for monies. If we're going to do a study, let's make sure the state puts the money where their mouth is.
Turning to Annapolis itself, I was listening to actually a Capital Summit by Mark Steiner, who holds up every year. And in terms of at least the top Democratic leadership, Mike Miller, for example, Michael Bush on the House of Delegates side, they seem to think as if the governor's not talking to them, that when he talks about negotiating, he doesn't know who he's talking with. It sounds like the tensions are running high between at least the governor and this leadership, even though the issues don't necessarily are as, perhaps not as catastrophic or not as dramatic, for instance, as maybe sometimes in the past. What sense do you get about that relationship?
Well, I can tell you, I've already talked about President Miller, how long he's known the governor. I know that both publicly and privately, he has expressed his desire to work. I know they go to the basketball games and Maryland basketball games at times together. They've had dinner together. I know that willingness to work is there. But let me tell you about me, the relationship that I have. When I pick up the phone and I call the governor's administration, case in point, live weight poultry trucks here. The Maryland Farm Bureau and DPI wanted to have that weight increased. I put the bill in last year, went to the table. We were trying to find a support letter from MTA, Maryland Transportation Authority. We couldn't find it, so we weren't able to get the bill passed. This year, I said, look, I don't want to put this bill back in if the administration is not going to show up. And we started to move towards solution. Next thing I know, it appeared that they were MIA. I picked up the phone myself and talked to Secretary Pete Ron of Transportation. My bill hearing was the next day on Wednesday. I talked to him. We had a very good conversation. Wednesday morning, I was getting ready to walk into the hearing. One of the administration folks pulled me aside and said, Governor Hogan made the call and said, let's get this bill passed. So, you know, that relationship is working for me. I have to make sure here that those relationships work. I already alluded to the beginning of that PMT. You know how contentious that was.
Yes.
And we worked very, very hard to protect poultry, but also our environment. And we had that bill prone that on the first day, which was the last day of the timeline to have those regs published, on the first day of Governor Hogan's administration, he was able to pull those regs, avoid them from getting to become permanent, go back and rework it. And, you know, I thank him for that. If you remember last year, I did modestly, and this I is not I, it is we, but you have to talk about leadership, individual effort and leadership. I talked about, again, beginning to plan for a third baseband crossing. I got the bill out of the Senate. Went over to the House, thought I had a pledge to have the bill moved on that last week, and a lot of issues were in play. And sadly, that bill didn't pass. Passed the Senate, but not the House. But in August, I got a call from the governor and said, meet me at the Bay Bridge. And if you recall, he announced the beginnings of that funding to do that environmental impact study for a third baseband. Again, another initiative, school after Labor Day. If you recall, I had the task force. We had the bill in twice. We weren't able to get the bill moved out of committee for one reason or another. The governor came and took leadership on my bill down on the boardwalk, did it by executive order. We worked on that the last couple of years. So I can only tell you respectfully about my relationship with the governor. It's been a good one. I can tell you that what I see from President Miller, he and I are modestly very close. He'll tell me when hey, look, Jim, you're not thinking this through correctly, or, you know, I can only help you so much, or whatever I'm trying to say. But I see the overtures that he makes. Speaker Bush and I are friendly. You know, it was, you know, God bless Bennett Bosman. When Bennett Bosman passed away, I replaced Bennett. There were 6 months left on his term. But it was Speaker Bush that called and said, would you consider leaving being mayor of Ocean City to come up here? We need you up here. And so I only know the relationships that I've been able to forge. I have good ones with both the leadership, the presiding officers. I believe I have a good one with Governor Hogan, and I want to continue to mesh those good relationships for the people of the Eastern Shore and the people of Maryland. I work on it every day, every minute of every day. I love what I'm doing. I really enjoy helping people here. We help people every day, and I encourage them to please reach out when I can be of help or come up and visit us. We just hit the halfway point on Friday, our 45th day. So we've probably done about 10, 15% of the work. So we have a lot of work coming up with very busy schedules. But I really encourage our folks here from the Lower Eastern Shore, Worcester, Wicomico, and Somerset to come up and watch us at work or to call us or to email us with their thoughts and their concerns.
We've been speaking with State Senator Jim Mathias, one of the lone Democrats on the shore. Maybe we'll talk about that at another time. I appreciate you stopping by and talking with
us. Well, absolutely. You have a great week, and I'm proud to be here with you today. Thank you, Don.
Thank you. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.